Inside Florida Politics, powered by Gannett. Hello, I'm Sarasota Herald Tribune political editor Zach Anderson, and I'm joined as always by Gannett State Capitol reporter John Kennedy. Hey, John.
Hi, Zach.
Well, Democrats across much of the country are feeling the burn as Bernie Sanders surges in the presidential primary and solidifies his frontrunner status with a big win in the Nevada caucus. But in Florida, Sanders' comments about life in Cuba under Fidel Castro are giving many Democrats heartburn. We'll talk about the firestorm Sanders ignited with his 60 Minutes interview and touch on the latest in the Florida legislature, including where things stand with Governor Ron DeSantis' priorities as the 60-day legislative session nears the finish line. But first, you all know what that music means. John, Bernie Sanders may like Cuba's literacy program, but I'm more interested in your number-picking skills. Give us a good one this week.
Very good. Yeah, well, Zach, I've been keeping my numbers low lately. That allows me to come in this week with an enormous one. Ready for this? It's 716,592.
716,592. That's huge. Huge. You got me beat this week, John. My number is a lowly 64. So that's 64 for me, 716,592 for John. Remember those numbers, folks. Write them down. We will come back to them at the end of the show and tell you what they mean in Florida politics. Well, socialism is a big buzzword these days, with the GOP trying to paint Democrats as the party of big government social programs. As a self-described democratic socialist, Bernie Sanders gives Republicans plenty of ammunition to make that case. Here in Florida, the criticism has special resonance because we have a lot of immigrants who fled autocratic socialist regimes in Cuba, Venezuela, throughout Latin America, Nicaragua. So some Democrats, especially in South Florida, already were on edge about Bernie Sanders being the Democratic presidential nominee and what that could mean really for the party's image. Then this happened. Here's a clip of Sanders on 60 Minutes last Sunday.
We're very opposed to the authoritarian nature of Cuba. But, you know, it's unfair to simply say everything is bad. You know, when Fidel Castro came into office, you know what he did? He had a massive literacy program. Is that a bad thing? Even though Fidel Castro did it?
Now, anything less than unequivocal condemnation of the Castro regime is pretty dicey in South Florida. And Democrats from that region quickly moved to distance themselves from Sanders. Javier Fernandez, a Democrat running for a state Senate seat, put out a statement saying, quote, "The comments by Bernie Sanders are foolish, reckless, and wildly insensitive. They are offensive to me, my family, and to every Cuban American, including thousands who faced repression, imprisonment, and the loss of loved ones at the hands of the cruel and dictatorial Castro regime." Meanwhile, two Democratic congresswomen who flipped GOP-held seats in South Florida in 2018 also lashed out at Sanders. John, do you think Florida Democrats should be worried about Sanders getting the nomination? There seems to be some big concerns about whether his views could hurt the ticket here.
Well, the Castro comments certainly didn't help Floridians feel any better about Bernie Sanders. As you pointed out, any soft view of Castro or accomplishments in Cuba during the Castro regime are almost reflexively condemned by the exile community in Florida, and the generations who have grown up here since Castro came to power. You know, hearing stories of what families lost fleeing their Cuban homeland or family members imprisoned there, and the supplies that so many of these families have sent back to their Cuban relatives who were lacking so many basics for so many years. The Florida Democratic Party chairman, Terry Rizzo, she clearly sensed the problems with Sanders' remarks. She quickly put out a statement after the 60 Minutes appearance, without naming Sanders directly, but her quote was, "Candidates need to understand our immigrant community's shared stories, as well as provide solutions to issues that matter to all Floridians." Rizzo sees the potential of this, in a state where already Sanders was facing something of an uphill climb as this Democratic socialist that, you know, in a retirement-rich state may not go over so well. You mentioned Fernandez, the Miami Democrat who is running to flip a Republican seat in the Florida Senate. He also said that a Trump win in Florida is virtually guaranteed if Sanders is the nominee, and that it's going to make it tougher for him and other Democrats to win seats in Florida. There's probably a lot of truth in that. You know, Florida is a toss-up state, but it seems to lean Republican and doesn't need much of a nudge. But Sanders taking the upside of Castro is a shove that not only alienates a lot of Cuban-American voters, but it really plays into fears that so many older voters in this heavily older voter state have when it comes to considering Sanders and his ideas. And, you know, it's funny, you know, this seems like 100 years ago. But remember last June, before the very first presidential debate held in Miami, then candidate Bill de Blasio, the New York mayor, he caught heat for going to a rally with striking workers at the Miami airport. And he used a Che Guevara line, hasta la victoria siempre, meaning right. Until victory always. So, you know, he had to apologize for it. Terry Rizzo put out a statement then as well. But so far, Bernie Sanders hasn't apologized. He said truth is truth. And he seems to be, you know, standing by that comment about early literacy gains under Castro.
One of the interesting things about the current the political climate here in Florida, if you look nationally, Democrats in 2018 picked up a lot of districts that Trump carried by running moderate candidates. But here in Florida, especially in South Florida, these two congressional seats that they picked up, these were districts that Hillary Clinton carried, you know, that they've gone blue at the presidential level. And I think this district that Javier Fernandez is running for, this state Senate seat, may be a district that Clinton carried as well. But you see split ticket voters. You see at the local level in the past, a lot of these, you know, Cuban voters, other Latin American voters have gone for Republican candidates at the local level for various reasons. And one of them might be because of this, this socialism issue and taking a tough line against Cuba. I guess I just wonder, what do you think, John? Does this down ticket? I mean, obviously, we've talked about whether Sanders can win Florida and that maybe, it could be more difficult for him than other candidates. Does he drag down the rest of the ticket here potentially?
Yeah, the potential is there, certainly. If these candidates can perhaps separate themselves from the top of the ticket, if necessary, you know, going forward, maybe they can survive. But it's one of those things that, doubtlessly, Sanders has a strong base. He has a strong pool of, you know, largely younger voters who want to see real systemic change in this state and the nation. And that has a strong appeal. But you have to wonder, is that base large enough to offset the pool of moderates that seem to be out there that are susceptible to a Democratic nominee, that are maybe, you know, not really Trump fans, that are looking for somebody to vote for that's not Trump? But are they going to be alienated by a top of the ticket that promises such a widespread change, whether that be, you know, private health insurance, you know, an economy that is relatively driven by corporate profits, that, all those things that seem to be endangered by a Sanders presidency, if that were to come to be.
And we've talked about how Andrew Gillum made the same argument that Sanders is. Andrew Gillum, the Democrat who ran for governor in Florida in 2018 and really made the same pitch that, I am going to bring out voters who haven't participated, young people, minorities, and he fell short. So we'll see. Presidential election is a different race. People pay more attention, and maybe Sanders can bring out more of those voters than Gillum was able to. But certainly, a lot of people are concerned about how some of his views play, especially in South Florida. I mean, one thing that Democrats like about Sanders is he's consistent. He doesn't change his views for the sake of political expediency. He's long been intrigued by some of these Cold War communist era socialist governments. I think the Washington Post had a story this week about how Sanders traveled to Cuba, Russia, and Nicaragua during the Cold War and said, you know, pretty good things about what he saw. But when you're trying to become president and Florida is the biggest swing state in the country and the biggest prize for any campaign, it kind of seems like you should be a little bit more careful about how you talk about Cuba. Anybody who knows about South Florida politics knows that that's a sensitive issue here. So we'll see. Bernie's going to Bernie. Maybe like Trump, he's able to touch some of these third rail issues and not get burned. Only time will tell. Of course, it wasn't just Democrats who lashed out at Sanders after his Castro comments. Republicans were eager to criticize him, including Governor Ron DeSantis, who said, quote, "Any attempts to whitewash the brutality of the Castro dictatorship is totally unacceptable." Going after Bernie may have been a welcome distraction for DeSantis, who is approaching the end of his second legislative session with really all of his big priorities still up in the air. The governor wants to crack down on illegal immigrants, boost teacher pay, and fight water quality problems, among other proposals. But as of right now, none of these bills have been approved. John, there's a lot that needs to happen in the next 2 weeks for DeSantis to declare victory. Do you think he's going to get there?
Yeah, for all the uncertainty right now, I do think DeSantis is going to be declaring victory the last night of the legislative session. That's March 13th. Now, what he winds up with, though, may be a thinner version of what he'd been seeking, especially when it comes to e-verify, the federal database that he wants all workers to have to be subject to when they get hired by a company, to make sure that they have legal status to work in this country. He has a big occupational licensing overhaul he wants that looks like it's going to be not as bold as he likes to call them. That glittering teacher pay plan that he wanted to bring base salaries to $47,500 a year, that would have been the second highest in the nation. All these look like they're going to be some variation of what he wants, but maybe not at precisely what he wants. It will carry enough of a similarity or veneer of getting everything he wants that I think the governor is going to be saying that he's pleased. But with so much in politics, optics are important, and there's a good chance that at least all the bullet points on DeSantis' wish list will be met by the legislature. But when you drill into what he's getting, it may be a more modest version of the bold agenda that he said he wanted. DeSantis, when he opened the session in January with his State of the State address, he spoke to legislators for more than half an hour, and he used the word bold five separate times. But what the legislature looks like it's ready to hand him is certainly something less. And, this isn't even including the possibility that in budget deals that are still to be negotiated, there remains a strong chance that Visit Florida, the tourism marketing agency, is going to be eliminated over his objections. And again, he's seeking bigger money for Florida Forever, the environmental land buying program, and the state's affordable housing fund also may come up short of what he wanted. So, a lot of it is still to be determined, but DeSantis a week ago was already practicing his victory speech, telling reporters that he thought, this year was looking even better than last year. But I think these next 2 weeks are going to decide that.
I mean, a lot of politics is about messaging and trying to spin things to make them seem favorable. Do you think that DeSantis can declare victory with E-Verify Lite and a watered-down water quality bill and just basically, say, hey, we got what we wanted and sort of gloss over the more ambitious aspects of what he was asking for?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, he'll be challenged if he does try to do that. But I think in very broad terms, he can still talk about, this year accomplishments, maybe not as far as they wanted to go, the work to be done, into the future. But for a Republican governor and a Republican legislature in an election year, I think he can probably come away claiming some level of accomplishment. But whether Floridians are really going to feel the differences is another question.
A lot to watch in the next 2 weeks as the legislative session comes to a close. One issue that's not a DeSantis priority, but appears to be a big priority for GOP leaders in the Florida House, is a bill that would make some really big changes to the state's university system. The legislation abolishes New College of Florida and Florida Polytechnic University as independent institutions and makes them satellite campuses of the University of Florida. That would shrink Florida's university system from 12 schools down to 10. And that's a significant overhaul of the university system, essentially doing away with two schools by grafting them on to UF. One thing that has bothered a lot of people about the bill is how it has come about. Many people might not know much about New College or Florida Poly. They're both relatively small schools. in smaller towns. New College is here in Sarasota, while Florida Poly is in Lakeland. This week, during a committee hearing, even lawmakers who didn't represent those two communities where the schools are located were voicing concerns that the bill has really not received the type of public vetting that would be commensurate with the gravity of those changes. The legislation emerged without warning halfway through the 60-day session, and a lot of lawmakers said this basically came out of nowhere. The sponsor, Randy Fine, is saying these schools are inefficient and spend too much taxpayer money on each degree that they produce. And, some lawmakers said that, you know, maybe there's a good argument for that. But John, do you think he's giving critics a lot of ammo with the rushed process here? You've covered the legislature for years now. Is this something that you've seen a lot with controversial policy late in the session, sort of spring it on people and push it through as quickly as possible?
Well, it really does seem difficult to make a straight-faced claim that this idea is really well thought out and subjective and makes sense, emerging really out of the blue at the midpoint of the session.
They're saying this is to save money. They don't even have a study of how much money this could save. I mean,
And both the universities that are affected and the sponsor of this bill, Representative Randy Fine, are arguing over the math. You know, they're clashing over the numbers that they use to justify their both positions. It's really a wild one. The idea that this legislation could be pushed through that eliminates two independent state universities as an efficiency, you would seem to think that it needs more than 4 weeks worth of chewing on. But, there is also a strong chance that this is largely a bargaining chit here with the Senate somehow. The House is advancing the idea, even though no House members are joining with Fine in criticizing the current system.
Yeah, not a single person spoke in favor of Fine's bill. Except Randy Fine. I mean, everybody was like, it was just a parade of people criticizing it. Not one person praised it. It just seemed kind of odd. Usually, you know, if you have something like this, people will jump on and try and support the sponsor. But it didn't seem like anybody really wanted to go to bat for this.
No, although also notable is his fellow Republicans are all voting for the consolidation. Right. You know, very quietly, they just vote yes. I asked Speaker Jose Oliva if he'd be willing to trade this consolidation idea for some of the ambitious healthcare regulatory changes that he's seeking, which aren't so well thought of in the Senate. And he didn't deny the idea. He just sort of said that he hadn't heard an offer yet. So maybe that's what it comes down to somehow in bargaining with the Senate in the closing days of the session. But, for the sake of New College and Florida Poly, they better hope that Oliva is open to a trade and that the Senate makes a decent offer. Because, again, this idea looks like it has bizarrely gained silent traction in the House. And it evidently isn't just fine venting because of some perceived slight from either of the schools or some other kind of personal vendetta. You know, we have seen those kind of things in the legislature before, but how public policy can be driven by some, you know, some guy's got a problem with something or someone. But in this case, it seems to have a little bit broader ambition as far as trying to, you know, make some change in this system. But whether the Senate goes along with it's a whole nother story.
Well, we're going to move on to our number picking. My number is 64, as in 64% of Floridians approve of the job Governor Ron DeSantis is doing, according to a University of North Florida poll released last week. That's right, another month and another poll showing Governor Ron DeSantis remains popular. And the reason for the governor's popularity is that he's pursuing policies that a lot of people really support. DeSantis's E-Verify proposal is backed by more than 70% of Floridians, according to the poll. Of course, not all of the governor's positions are popular. He doesn't want to mandate background checks on private gun sales, a proposal that is supported by 86% of Floridians, according to the UNF survey. And he's not for increasing Florida's minimum wage to $15 an hour, even though the poll found that 65% of Floridians support the wage hike. That level of support is noteworthy because the minimum wage proposal is going to be on the ballot in 2020, and it needs 60% support to pass. John, your number is 716,592. Tell us about that whopper.
Yeah, Zach, that number are the number of people who have already cast ballots. They voted by mail in the state's March 17th presidential primary. That's according to the state's Division of Elections through Wednesday morning, February 25th. Now, that's more than half of the number of people who have requested mail-in ballots. That was almost 1.4 million people. And about 58% of those mail-ins were going to registered Democrats. So the Dems are clearly more excited than the Republicans, who will dutifully go through the motions of renominating Donald Trump. But these mail-in voters are the early birds here in Florida. We know all about early birds in Florida. Zach, in Sarasota, where you live, I'm sure you know the early bird specials
throughout that region. Lights from all over the country.
but when it comes to these early birds who've mailed in their ballots already, the Dems are cautious. Only 36% of those returned mail-in ballots are from Democrats. So what does that mean? I think it means that in a crazy multi-candidate state, multi-candidate presidential race, I should say, where we have South Carolina's primary coming up, followed a few days later by the big Super Tuesday contest in 14 states, Florida Democrats are still sizing these candidates up. They're wondering, you know, is Amy Klobuchar going to be around by Florida? Elizabeth Warren? Even Joe Biden, who's expected to win South Carolina? So it's kind of a typical Florida story. These early bird voters are still looking at the menu. Maybe we'll see a strong turnout in old school fashion at the polls when primary day and St. Patrick's Day converge on March 17th. People will actually have to go and vote that day.
Yeah, absentee voting is convenient, but when you have these primaries where candidates are getting knocked off, you know, every week here, so probably better to hold on to your ballots and wait to see who's still standing by the time Florida actually votes. Well, that wraps up another episode of Inside Florida Politics. I want to thank our audio production team of Thomas Forty and Jason Pisano, and thanks to all of you